Welcome to the Guffman. I'm Alex, and the person opening a canned beverage is James.
It's me.
Yeah. Just before we get started, we just want to invite you to check out our website, guffman.com. We've put out some good content recently. Last week, our podcast was about The Daily Show. And I wrote something about Shia LaBeouf and why we are interested in celebrities and why some people claim to not be interested in celebrities. That's actually being fairly well received, not unlike our podcast on the Mighty Ducks from 2 weeks ago, which we would also implore you to check out. If you're listening to us for the first time, be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes. Search the MacGuffin Men, all one word. And while you're there, maybe give us a rating. We would recommend 5 stars, but we are not impartial listeners. So, yeah. And also follow us on Twitter, at the MacGuffin Men, all one word. And, yeah, I think that's it. Let's just get to the theme song, shall we? Oh, one more thing this week. I don't know if we're posting this podcast on Tuesday or Thursday yet, but whichever day this podcast is not posted on, I wrote something about Kendrick Lamar's new record that is maybe worth reading, and we'll probably have some overlap with some of the things we talk about in this podcast even. But yeah, so check that out, themacguffinmen.com. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell people you don't know on the street who you randomly pass by. But yeah, let's just get to the theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
So what are we talking about here today, James?
Today we are talking about Cloud Atlas.
Okay.
Which very recently hit theaters.
Yes. Now, I have one question for you right off the bat. Where the hell do we start?
Yeah, that's tough. It is a very sprawling film. Mm-hmm. To put it gently.
Yeah.
But it was, it started as a novel, so we can start there, I guess.
Okay.
2004 novel written by David Mitchell. Very well received, like a lot of awards and award nominations and things like that. But yeah, I can see how this movie, I mean, after seeing it, you know how it happens, but I can see how this novel would be something that is hard to turn into a film.
Yeah, and from what I understand, they changed the structure a little bit.
Yeah, they did. I think in the novel, well, the movie is 6 different stories,
mm-hmm.
Or is it just one big story?
Ooh.
No. 6 different stories, but cut together very, you know, quick, well, not very quickly, but a few minutes at a time, you'll jump from scene to scene. And I mean, these are scenes ranging from the 1800s till the 2200s,
yeah.
I guess is the way to put that.
Yeah.
You know, all over the world and different characters. So, yeah, that's what I mean by it's kind of very sprawling and ambitious. We're talking lots of different time periods, lots of different characters.
Yeah, and I would be surprised if at any point in the movie you spend one 10-minute chunk in any time period without flipping to another one.
Right. So, yeah, so the movie's all over the place. The book, my understanding, and I haven't read it, is that 5 of the stories are pretty much told at a time, like in consecutive pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Like you'll get one story, the next one, the next one, the next one. And then 1 of the stories is split into 2. So there's only really 7 different, I guess, chapters, you could say. Whereas in the film, if you wanted to break it down into chapters, you'd be looking at, I don't even know, at least 50, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I don't even want to count.
yeah.
No, from what I understand about the book is that the first half of, I think, a few stories plays, and then the whole last story, like latest in the chronology of the movie, happens in the middle, and then you get it doesn't matter. We haven't read the book. We're guessing about something we haven't read. This is idiotic.
Right. Well, yeah.
I apologize to all of our listeners.
Do you like the way that they did this, though? Kind of, they do split it up into pieces, but this is one thing that I did like about the movie is that we get kind of 6 stories at once, pretty much. So we're kind of hitting the same beat 6 times in a row.
Mm-hmm.
You know, usually when we hit a beat in the story. Did you like that? Did you think that worked? Or
yes.
Yeah.
The 2 things I love the most about this movie is when different parts of the stories would come together.
Yeah.
Like, 'cause it seemed like every 40 minutes or so we would get like this sort of like musical sequence with intercut with voiceover from one time period, and we're seeing visuals from a variety of other time periods. And I thought all of those cut together very well. I thought the score in this movie was very good and really helped in those scenes.
Yeah.
And I felt like I really enjoyed those parts of the movie a lot. And the other thing I liked is that, I know I told you this, but I haven't mentioned it on the podcast yet. I didn't see a trailer for this movie before I saw it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if the experience is different for somebody that did see a trailer, but I had no idea what was happening for the first hour. I found it like totally disorienting, and I loved that. Like,
yeah.
I was lost. I had no idea what was happening. It was awesome. So any movie that I just, I mean, it's not even that I was expecting one thing and got another. It was just sort of that I had no idea what to expect. And what I got when I was actually watching it was like almost impenetrable at the beginning. I really liked that.
Yeah. I've kind of read some other people who had the same experience, but when we start with Tom Hanks, the future Tom Hanks, kind of post-apocalyptic Hawaii.
Yeah.
With the tattoo on the face.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a very particular dialect, I guess you can say.
Yeah, true.
I found him very hard to understand at times.
Oh, I couldn't understand a word he was saying. Particularly because, like, the first scene of the movie, they throw you right into that. I had no idea what he was saying.
I know. And I had seen the trailer, so I kind of expected this movie not to be the most accessible spoon-feeding example of filmmaking ever.
Yep.
And when they drop us into that, and I'm like, I don't know what you're saying. This is going to be really tough because I don't know what is happening or what's being said to attempt to explain it. I found that kind of throughout the movie, not even in his scene. There was a couple times I really just couldn't make out the dialogue.
Yep. No, I agree with that. And
we are dealing with accents and, you know, different dialects and things like that. And, you know, futuristic slang, which is hard to know.
Exactly. And that's, again, something I liked about this movie that I assume some people would have problems with, is that they don't dumb down. You could also make the argument that they're just, you know, doing things difficultly just to seem more impressive that way or something, like sort of like just be so vague that you have to think that there was a deeper meaning there or something. With the dialects and voices that are hard to tell what they're saying. But no, I like that. I'm the type of person that would like that. And there are large sections of this movie where I honestly just sort of stopped paying attention and just sort of watched it and still enjoyed it. I feel like I would get a lot out of a second viewing of this movie. But
yeah. So I have a question for you off the bat then, if we're going to play that game.
Uh-huh.
You worked at TIFF in some capacity this year.
Yes.
This movie premiered at TIFF.
Yes.
And received a 10-minute standing ovation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember a lot of buzz about this? I mean, I know you said you didn't see the trailer, but I think you were kind of aware of this, and it's kind of been a long time coming, and the Wachowski brothers... Ooh, sorry. Last time that should happen.
Yeah. The Wachowskis.
The Wachowskis, the Wachowski siblings. Wachowski Starship, as I've heard them call themselves lately.
That's funny.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. I mean, their huge hit was obviously the Speed Racer.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
The other one, Matrix. So,
are we sure it wasn't Bound? I'm pretty sure it was Bound.
You're probably thinking of Ninja Assassin.
That was a James McKetticue film or whatever, whoever did V for Vendetta.
But okay,
they produced it, yeah.
Oh, there it is. Yeah, so they kind of are high profile since The Matrix.
Yes.
As I kind of accidentally broached a little while ago, Larry Wachowski, I think in 2008... completed sexual or gender reassignment transition.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And for this movie was the first time that she had done kind of interviews.
Yeah.
And in public.
Yeah. And she's now known as Lana.
Yeah.
But I mean, she's sort of, this sort of started to happen, I think, when they were shooting The Matrix Reloaded and Revolutions, was when sort of Larry sort of went through, I don't know,
It's a long process.
Yeah, exactly. But it's sort of where Larry realized that she was Lana and that she had become comfortable with that. And this happened when they were shooting the sequels to the Matrix movies, which shot at the same time in Australia. And Yeah, and the press was sort of abuzz about it, and since the Wachowskis just didn't do press until basically this movie, or didn't do a lot of it, it was just sort of, it was even more hard to get to or something. I don't know. It was just, the story as I understand it was that Larry realized she was Lana, and then like the next day just showed up to set to work on Reloaded and Revolutions, just dressed as, you know, as Lana, and that nobody really batted an eye about it. And then people just sort of started to get, like the press started to figure things out on, I don't know, on the set and report on it and stuff. Because yeah. I do remember reading about this long, long ago.
Yeah. So, well, yeah, what I was getting at is that was kind of something of a story. So that was, you know, in the media a bit. And again, with just Matrix being as big as it was.
Exactly. And at that time, the Matrix sequels are arguably the most anticipated movies to be released, you know?
Yeah. So. Well, yeah, well, just getting at their kind of high profile. I mean, people are pretty aware of them between their career and, you know, what happened in her personal life there. Do you remember a lot of talk about this at TIFF?
No, not at all. I was pretty far removed from the biggest venues. I did a lot of the smaller premieres, like for a movie that Dustin Hoffman directed and Joss Whedon something. But yeah, no, I didn't hear much about Cloud Atlas at all. It was weeks after the festival that I found out about the standing ovation.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm sorry that I can provide no insider info.
No, that's okay. I just kind of want to get any idea of, you know, how much buzz was around this. I always love reading the length of the standing ovation.
It's like, so weird to me.
It's the weirdest thing in the world to me, because no matter how much you liked a movie, at the 1 minute mark, you're like, okay, how long is this going on for?
Yeah.
And we're doing this because someone's timing it.
Yeah. It's this weird negotiation with everybody else in there, but there's no actual negotiating going on.
Yeah.
It's just sort of like, I feel like I would always be the first person to stop this. To like just sit down and just be like, I'm tired. I'm done.
Absolutely. And at what point, like, if half the crowd's sitting but the rest are standing, do we still count that? Or is the clock running at half speed at that point or what?
Yeah. At what point do we have to worry about getting the next audience in? Because you know there's another premiere going on.
Yeah.
So you've got a Q&A to get through and you're just clapping. You just won't shut up. I can answer your questions if you'll just shut up and stop applauding.
Yeah, but I mean, between the novel doing well, the Wachowskis being attached to it.
We should also mention there is a third director on this film, Tom Tykwer.
Oh, yeah, Tom Tykwer. And he helped write it as well.
Yes.
Yeah, and so the three of them kind of got Cloud Atlas. They all read the novels, you know, kind of really took to them and wrote kind of separate drafts on their own and then collaborated on them.
Mm-hmm.
And for the actual filming, the Wachowskis would work in one unit as, you know, co-directors. And Tom Tykwer, that's the pronunciation we're
going
to go
with? That's what I'm going with, yeah.
Okay, let's do that. He kind of worked an entirely separate unit. Mm-hmm. And other than the cast, it was pretty much two entirely different things being shot.
Yeah, but they sort of... We're all, like, in the storyboarding and editing process, everything except the actual shooting, everything was done as a trio. And so that's what, when thinking about the movie after, when I saw the director title card come up, like, I just entirely, I don't know if I forgot necessarily, because I was definitely conscious of this going into the movie, that it was the Wachowskis and Tom Tykwer. But, like, when I saw the three directors on the card at the end, I was like, oh, yeah. It was totally seamless, you know, and it, like there was no, when I saw the segments that were directed by the Wachowskis and Tykwer, which are sort of spelled out at the end, I was like, yep, I wouldn't have been able to tell the difference. And I feel like the Wachowski movies I've seen compared to the Tykwer movies I've seen are very different. There's definitely similarities, but I feel like I was surprised at how seamless it was once I started thinking about it. But
right.
Yeah, that all comes from the fact that they storyboarded everything together, edited everything together. And the Wachowskis in an interview with the AV Club said it was very much like, well, we didn't think it was a big deal. It was, and I mean, our sound stages were right next to each other. They were Skyping constantly, texting constantly, like they were always in contact. And so it was just sort of, it was very much a three-person mind that just had sort of like hashed out everything they needed to before they got on set, which is something that people say about how the Wachowskis work together, is that very often they'll just sort of, after the end of a take, Lana will go talk to one person, and Andy will go talk to an actor, and then they'll just get up from their chairs, go their separate ways, do this thing, and then do whatever each of them feels they have to do, and then come and sit back down in their chair without ever speaking to each other and just doing another take. And it's just sort of they say that they just sort of go through all the arguments before they get on set, and that once they get on set, it's just sort of this one vision, and they just sort of work as one brain with two people.
Right on. Yeah, I saw, did you hear Tom Hanks' nickname for the two of them?
Yeah, I started calling them Mom and Dad, I think.
Yeah, just in a positive way, that they were like, kind of, as you were saying, such a team, and you know, just working very well together.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it, I think it bears mentioning that, do you know who directed which?
The only one I can remember is, I remember Tom Tykwer did the '70s. Everything else I do not remember.
Okay. Yeah. The Wachowskis did the 18th century one. Oh, sorry, the 19th century one. So the slave sailboat one.
Yep.
And they did the two future ones.
Okay.
So the Tom Hanks in the woods.
Yeah, I definitely would have guessed.
With the orcs.
Yeah, and I would have guessed the neo-soul stuff was.
I mean, it's got the word neo right in it.
Well, it's and that character is kind of like the neo of neo-soul.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I was really hoping she would like do a collaboration with D'Angelo or something, like a genre-saving D'Angelo single, and she would become the neo of neo-soul's neo-soul scene.
No.
Yes, absolutely. That happened. Write it down.
Print it.
Yeah. Moving on.
Okay. So actually, one more thing about production, just kind of speaking to how highly anticipated this movie was. One of the most expensive independent films of all time.
Yep. Yep.
And the first attempt at a German blockbuster. Did you see that?
I did read that quote. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's $102 million. So that's, that's a fair budget for a movie nowadays. It's not massive, but it's big.
Yeah. That's basically the lowest amount of money you could try and do this with, I think.
Yeah. No, I think so too. I mean, just the six different timelines and I thought everything looked good.
Yeah. No, I didn't have problems with the visuals of the movie. I thought like some of the cinematography I really liked, like in those segments I was talking about with the voiceover and the music. Another big part of those segments I liked was that the cinematography, there was a lot of like good steady cam and tracking shots and stuff like that during those. And, I didn't love anything about the visuals except for in those parts when you got some really good tracking shots and steady cam. But yeah, no, I thought it looked pretty good. It looked like $100 million movie.
Yeah. Did you like the plate? Well, not plate. The porcelain smashing scene.
I loved it.
I really loved that. That was the one thing that just stood out to me a lot. I actually liked that that segment, that whole storyline, that thread. I really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. But that scene was like one of the ones, especially visually, that actually just floored me.
Yeah, and the speech that's going on during that, the voiceover is very good. It's the one about breaking barriers. And I just really enjoyed that. That is my favorite 3-minute part of this movie, is that part.
Yeah, I'd have to say so too, to be honest. Like that part just really worked for me a lot.
Yeah.
Any favorite segments or least favorite segments? I mean, as far as the six? I feel like you... can I put forward a guess?
Yeah, absolutely.
What's his name? The old guy.
Jim Broadbent.
Yeah, but the character he plays when he's the publicist or the publisher who then gets into the old age home.
Yeah.
I feel like you loved the part when he's at the party with badass Tom Hanks.
Yes, absolutely.
And Tom Hanks throwing him over the balcony.
Big fan. Big fan of that part.
But then hated all the old folks home getaway stuff.
That's pretty much exactly how I felt about that. Okay. I wouldn't say I hated it because I did think it was funny. I just felt like it was in an entirely different movie.
Yeah, it didn't fit.
Yeah, and I mean, I feel like you kind of probably liked a lot of that plot line, right? Because it was funny. And I did think the humor was funny. Like, I didn't think it was just jokes that were there that didn't make me laugh. But
Yeah, because I just feel like with so many of these segments, if we took one of them and extrapolated it out to an entire film, which for a lot of these is absolutely not unheard of.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot going on in some
of
these.
Yeah, absolutely.
I feel like even the most serious ones, you'd get your moments of comic relief.
Mm-hmm.
And overall, that whole movie would have just as many jokes and laughs as the Cloud Atlas as it stands now, having that storyline, which is predominantly all comedy.
Yeah.
You know, I still think the balance to seriousness would be the same, but they just sucked the comic relief out of the other five parts and plugged it into that.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I mean, I like Jim Broadbent. He's a funny guy and he's a good actor.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it was just sort of, that was the, I don't know, the part of the movie I was probably least invested in. Although I don't think I would necessarily, like, if we're talking about breaking these six stories up into six separate movies, I don't know that I would like any one of them. Just as a standalone.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
I don't know. For some reason, the one with the composer.
Yeah, no, that's true. That is
that
good.
That one I think I like the most.
That was the one that sort of felt the most unique to me as well.
Yeah, and it kind of, even in the short one, it felt the most complete, even though the walking in on the suicide about a minute late, I always hate that move.
Yeah, no, it's always weak.
And starting off with the suicide, I'm always still not a big fan of.
Okay.
But a bunch of that storyline still worked for me when he shot him. And yeah, a lot of that stuff works for me.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I guess we kind of, not really doing the movie justice if we're talking about all these things as separate pieces, because as they are very quick to explain, it is all about the interconnectedness between these stories and these characters.
Yeah.
And their shooting star tattoos.
Yes.
Birthmarks.
Yeah.
How did you feel about them, kind of how they were interconnected? And I think there's a lot of people kind of talking about each actor really only playing one character, despite the fact they, you know, we cross all these geographical and temporal boundaries, that we're really looking at the character arc of one character. When we say Tom Hanks in this one and this one and this one and this one,
mm-hmm.
We're really only looking at one character. What's your take on that?
Well, there's a quote from Tom Tykwer who said that the actors were playing, and it's just a four-word quote, playing souls, not characters.
Right.
Which I think makes sense. The thing I did like about it was that I knew that actors would be playing multiple parts. And I was happy that they were very different sometimes from the role they would play in another. And I also really, really liked how many parts some of the actors were playing, to the point where sometimes I didn't realize how many parts an actor was actually playing until the end credits, when they sort of show the person's name and all of the faces they played. And
yeah,
I was a big fan of that. And like, it took me like till there was like maybe 40 minutes left in the movie where I figured out that Jim Sturgess was actually the guy helping the Neo. And I really liked that. And just, yeah, no, I thought that was really cool. I thought that was a really cool creative thing to do.
The stories are so different that, you know, obviously you're going to be playing notably different characters, but we're getting different races, different genders. Like,
yeah.
It's not, you know, in different ages. I mean, this is mixed up more than just what is necessary by having a story 200 years later.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I thought I cut you off.
No, that's it. I just like that.
That's it?
Yeah.
I guess some people... Yeah, I just kind of want to address people who are disliking this movie.
Okay, and... yeah, I haven't read a single review about this movie, so I'm curious to know
okay.
how it's been received.
Well, the obvious one is that the pretentious thing.
Okay.
Anytime you have a story that is not a strict narrative in a classical sense of following a single protagonist through one of their life experiences from beginning to end,
yeah,
you're going to get that argument.
Okay.
Which I can see.
Sure.
No, we kind of got some of the liberal media thing criticizing this movie because, you know, we get, you know, as we discussed, the gender transition of one of the Wachowskis. Mm-hmm. We have actors playing characters of different gender. Some people also like to throw in the fact that there is a homosexual relationship in this movie, which isn't the same thing as gender transition, but yeah, kind of gets thrown in there by some people.
Yeah. That basically anything from the LGBT community that appears in this film is getting thrown into one thing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's also, I mean, this kind of just ties up with the pretentious thing, but I've seen some comparisons to Tree of Life, which is something I wanted to ask you about in particular. Okay. It's vague is a kind of qualitatively neutral way to put it. Yeah. at times, the connection between what you're seeing and what you've seen. How do you feel about the Tree of Life comparison?
I don't know. I guess it's the first I've thought of it. The thing I was thinking about more was The Fountain.
Yeah, and that's an obvious one just because the different timelines.
Yeah, but there are big differences in the movies as well. But yes, you are correct. The timelines, notably, they're playing the same character in three different times in The Fountain, whereas this there's just tons of change. The Tree of Life. I don't know. I feel like this had a more defined idea behind it than Tree of Life. And again, that's just the thing with Terrence Malick's movies. I like that about Terrence Malick's movies.
Yeah. No, like, it's funny to hear that this is like the focused,
I think
simple
this
version.
I feel like this movie has very focused points that it makes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Thematically, just not kind of narratively.
I think it all comes together very, very well. I think like the, and by comes together very well, I think like parts of the ending are the things I dislike the most, but also I feel like the points that the movie is trying to get across, I feel like come across very strongly. And that's actually one of the things I don't like about the movie is that at some points it comes across too strongly. But
No, that was kind of one of my questions I wanted to get to is that it is vague. I mean, we kind of said that it doesn't really spoon feed you just in that it is so spread out over time and geography and things like that. And I, you know, I saw some people saying how it's like Tree of Life, or another one I saw was Magnolia as well, just because of the so many different stories happening at the same time.
Yeah. Okay.
no good.
I disagree, but
okay. Yeah. But,
I also generally disagree with the Tree of Life. Like I see the vague part, but other than that, I think they're vastly different movies.
Okay. But I saw some people saying that this kind of wants to be Tree of Life, or well, maybe not necessarily Tree of Life, but it wants to be one of those art house movies, I guess you could say, that kind of dances around a lot of stuff and doesn't tie everything to, you know, really obvious synopses and, you know, action driven stories.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of wants to be put in that league, but then every, you know, as you said, 40 minutes, they might do a voiceover thing and really drive something home. And it kind of dresses up like it wants to be an intelligent movie that lets the audience do all the work and piece it together. But then once in a while, we'll just hammer something home and take a point that, if not stated so explicitly, might be very, you know, thoughtful and, you know, thought-provoking, but that it just kind of drives it home to the point where it's no longer, you know, letting you do anything. It's letting you think you're doing something, but then really just hammering it home and making up your mind for you.
Yeah, I think it's just, I don't think it necessarily hammers it home. I just think one of the main points of this movie, one of the main points of this movie is sort of like a butterfly effect thing, but over a much longer period of time. Like the idea that in the first storyline, Tom Hanks's character is a bad person. He's an evil man. Then in the chronologically last storyline, Tom Hanks goes through like a real arc and becomes like a very good person by the end of the movie and at the end of this movie's timeline. And the idea is that all of these previous generations, like this one, these previous generations have influenced what comes after it. And I thought that was a little, they took that a little too far with sort of spelling it out, and with Halle Berry in the 70s raising her glass to a picture of her father. It drove me crazy. yeah. That was like a half a step down from a single tear is what that is. Raising a glass to a picture of a dead person is like just barely a step down from a single tear to me.
Like a step down as in not quite as bad.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Single tear is the worst thing that can happen in a piece of cinema other than a freeze frame.
Oh, freeze frame single tear.
Yeah, exactly. and then raising your glass to a dead person. But yeah, no, I thought they drove that home a little too hard. But I felt like for the most part, I do think the Wachowskis and Tickler were aspiring to make something that was also entertaining. Like they wanted to make something that reached a wide audience. They wanted it to be more difficult than something that would traditionally reach a wide audience, but they were very much aiming for blockbuster success still. They wanted to do it on their terms, and they had to, and that's why they had to be independently financed. But yeah, I don't know. I've sort of lost track of what I was even saying. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to start 5 different arguments.
Okay. I think I just... See, this movie just baffles me. I can't even keep a straight timeline.
Yeah. No. You start that one. I'll start 5 other ones. Okay. And then when I'm done my 5, maybe you thought of the next part of that argument.
Okay. One thing I was surprised about this movie, I was surprised by how little action there was in it. Were you?
No.
Okay.
Because what do we have? Like... 2 action sequences?
I feel like there must be more than that, but there's like a couple little ones that are very like very small, but
we have that slave doing something to the sail. That was kind of action.
That was awesome. That was really very, liked that scene.
That was very cool.
And when he just like swings on the rope and then slides back. Oh, I love that. That was great. Yeah.
That was good.
Yeah. I also just didn't like the action in this movie. I didn't find particularly engaging, but
no. And then I guess there's just Neo's escape.
Yeah. No, but I was just curious as to what you expected along those lines, because I guess I expected more. But
yeah, I mean, I guess I watched the trailer, so I kind of knew that 5 of these were going to be pretty light on the action. I mean, is Halle Berry being driven off a bridge by someone named Bill Smoke?
That was cool. That was super scene? Cool. I thought that was...
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah.
What? Am I ever going to stop loving Hugo Weaving as much as I do?
Probably not.
Good.
Yeah.
I don't want to.
No.
Yeah, but I mean, I kind of knew most of these were going to be pretty light.
Okay.
I did feel like blowing up Tom Hanks's plane was a bit overkill.
Okay. It did sort of come pretty quickly. Like, we've barely met that guy. He's just like, oh, I love her. Boom, dead. But I mean, like,
even from the people in the story, I mean, they knew who he was. They knew what flight he was going to. Like, can't you kill him before the plane takes off?
No, there are better ways to do that.
That's just reckless.
Yeah.
His little speech there about that girl is kind of sweet. And I'm not big on the we've met in past lifetimes reincarnation stuff typically.
Yeah.
But I think this movie does that pretty well. And not just the reincarnation stuff, but just a lot of the things about people being interconnected, and you know, her reading letters written by a different character, and one character's, you know, short leg of a table being held up by a book, a journal someone else had written. Mm-hmm. You know, the music being written by in the 1930s one there, being on a record, and then them meeting up over that. And yeah, not just in the, you know, butterfly effect kind of way, but just the small ways in that these characters don't even realize they've affected or been affected by some of the other segments of the movie.
Yeah.
I thought they did that better than a lot of, you know, text that approach that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think there are a lot of things that I thought like just were bad about this movie, like really small things, like the Tom Hanks speech that you were mentioning. I did not like that at all. I thought it was kind of silly, but like there's tons of stuff like that, but I think as a whole, I feel like the movie gets a lot more right than it does wrong. And on the type of scale that we're going for, that's extremely impressive. And
yeah.
I'm always interested in seeing something new, and I don't feel like I've seen a movie like Cloud Atlas before. I feel like the closest thing, and I mentioned it already, the closest thing to a Hollywood-ish movie that I've seen like this is The Fountain. And I think this is an entirely different movie from The Fountain, and I think it's much more ambitious. I don't think it's necessarily better, but anytime something gets a wide release that's as crazy as Cloud Atlas, I'm counting it as a win for filmgoers, you know?
Yeah. Okay, so...
Like, I do not think... This isn't a great movie, and I would have trouble recommending it to people I don't know very well.
Yeah,
but just counting it as a victory for for film.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, and I had a question about this, so okay. It seems like a good time. There is a Collider article that's out there saying why, I'm paraphrasing the title, but it's something like why Cloud Atlas is one of the most important movies for you to see.
Okay.
And it's not because it's life affirming and it's the new Pay It Forward or anything like that.
Which, coincidentally, not a lot of people actually ended up seeing. But,
I know. Yeah. I just wanted to say Pay It Forward. You say the point of the article is that it's taking these chances and it is doing something new. And the author says it's, you know, he isn't saying that it's such a well-made movie or that it changed his life. But in the, you know, movie landscape that we're in right now, and so many people are complaining about so many things being sequels or off, you know, pre-existing properties, which, I mean, this was a novel. I'm aware that this wasn't entirely original, but
yeah,
it's not a comic book. It's, you know, not a TV show or a board game or something that's already been established in that way.
Novel to film has always been a more traditional way of, you know,
yes,
novel to movie has been around much longer than comic book to movie.
And certainly, even with kind of the new appreciation comic book films got in the past decade, which we've talked about before, it's still always seen as the classier way.
Yeah. Yeah.
It, you know, it kind of has some panache to it.
Yeah. All the President's Men was based on a book, you know, like Batman.
Yeah.
Batman was based on Batman.
Yeah, exactly. And kind of the point of the article is just that in this time when so much stuff is rehashed or just taken from these pre-existing properties, it's important to let something like this be seen. And if it is going to get made, that you go see it because, you know, I think maybe you would agree with some of those points just because of how you feel, you know, when watching this, you haven't seen something like this. And even if it doesn't do everything right, even if, you know, you say 50-50, it does some things really well, does some things really poorly. It's important to see a movie like this. So movies like this, and by like this, I mean like anything,
yeah.
Like, you know, not necessarily this style, but something just stylistically so different is important.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't want people to see something that they're not going to actually enjoy.
Yeah.
And I think I would be happy if this movie was a colossal hit, if this movie was Avatar, I would love it. I really don't think that will be the case. I don't think it's going to make a ton of money. But
it won't.
Okay. Have you seen numbers for this? We're taping this on the Saturday after it's released.
I think it's 10 mil for the weekend so far, but oh, okay. That's not good.
No, it's certainly not going to be a blockbuster then.
It's splitting critics kind of down the middle, which doesn't surprise me. And aggregate sites are putting it kind of low. So
okay, well, and this is sort of, I feel like that Collider article that you mentioned, I haven't read it, but sometimes critics feel like their work is more important than it actually is. It's good that movies like Cloud Atlas can still get made, and I mean, we had a movie that I was thinking about a lot while watching Cloud Atlas, from as little as a month ago, was Looper, that I thought this movie kind of reminded me of a lot. And I feel like we still get a bunch of really interesting movies a year, and I don't feel like that there's some social responsibility for the casual filmgoer to see this. Certainly people like me will see it and people like me will like it, but I'm not going to tell one of my roommates who I think will hate this movie, I'm not going to be like, you have a duty to film as a film fan to go see this movie. I think that's
right.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
But I understand the sort of, it's not necessarily a fanboy mentality, but it's the critic's version of a fanboy mentality. Like, that's sort of how I was talking about Young Adult for so long, just because that was a movie that I felt was a really, really strong movie and a really good movie for people living in modern society to see. And also just for, as a filmmaking, I really like the writing of that movie. But yeah, I didn't feel obligated to recommend it to everybody I've ever met, you know, I wanted everybody to see it, but I didn't want everybody that would hate it to see it, you know?
Yeah. And that kind of sours people's experience on all of movies.
Yeah, exactly. If I tell you, I don't know, it's sort of how I feel about Forrest Gump. I didn't watch Forrest Gump for so long, and I think it's a bad movie. I do not like it. And I think it was just sort of one of those things that people told me about for literally 20 years before I saw it. And I just didn't, or sorry, not, I guess 20 years, but
I feel like 20 is an exaggeration.
A solid 15. And yeah, no, I just didn't like it. And I'm sure there are things I would have hated about that movie in 1993 or whenever it was released. But it's always, people are always warring against expectations. And it's sort of, by writing things like that, you're raising expectations for Cloud Atlas to the common film goer who also doesn't sort of think about criticism like film critics do. Yeah. And I think that as a whole is worse. Like,
yeah,
I hate calling anything difficult, but it is sort of a more difficult movie than the average thing. But yeah, it's also still enjoyable to watch. It's still a very well put together movie. It's sort of like the Kendrick Lamar album that I've been talking about. Like, it's the music version of Young Adult recently is really good, and critics have been calling it really difficult, which I think is bullshit, because it's also just really enjoyable to listen to if you don't want to break down why it's great. And
yeah.
I feel like just watching Cloud Atlas is an enjoyable experience, even without thinking about it all that much.
I mean, there are just some of the, like, I think the future one, you don't have to think about it in relation to anything.
Yeah.
And it's pretty easy and enjoyable.
Yeah.
It definitely ties into a bunch of the themes of some of the other ones, but
it's the most, like, snappily engaging part of the movie.
Yeah, because it does have a lot of action and brings up a lot of things really quickly. And
it's got sort of the futuristic environment that people always like looking at.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think that depictions of the future are just very interesting.
Yeah.
Just, you know, I think to anybody. Yeah, they definitely are to me. Maybe they are less to some other people, but I think it's such just a fascinating subject to try and take a stab at.
Mm-hmm.
That it's, you know, pretty easily engaged.
And also, I mean, Hugh Grant in the 70s, everybody would love that.
Of course.
I got such a big kick out of him in that suit and sunglasses. I loved it so much.
And he's just such a dick.
Hugh. He's the British Matthew McConaughey.
And I liked him as the orc, too.
No, I actually kind of, and I felt kind of bad making a joke about Hugh Grant in something I wrote a while back, but I actually feel like Hugh Grant is the British Matthew McConaughey. I like Matthew McConaughey more than I like Hugh Grant, but I feel like Hugh Grant is better than the movies he's in typically. So,
okay.
Which is not a popular opinion to have. But I feel like there's something coming for Hugh Grant where he'll be very good in.
And it's not this?
No, I liked him in parts of this, but he has such a small role.
Yeah.
Or small roles, I guess.
Small several roles.
Yeah.
Probably the most important question about my Cloud Atlas experience.
Yeah.
Would you rather see Lincoln or Les Miserables?
I'm actually very curious to see Les Mis.
Really?
Yeah. If nothing else, that movie's going to be gorgeous. It's directed by Tom Hooper, I think his name is. He did the King's Speech, which was a movie I didn't love, but the cinematography was amazing. And just looking at the cinematography in that trailer, Les Mis is going to be a gorgeous movie that I might not like, but I'll love watching. But also, a funny story about the Lincoln trailer. I was, like, sitting as the trailers were starting today when I saw the movie. I was like, I kind of want popcorn. I haven't eaten anything today.
But when did you want it? Did you want it now?
Shut up. And I was like, oh, I'm really on the fence. I don't know if I want this popcorn. And then the Lincoln trailer started. I was like, I can't take this. I'm going to get popcorn immediately. I took that as a sign that I needed to get rid of, get popcorn to get away from the Lincoln trailer again.
In the meantime.
And not like I didn't watch Cloud Atlas trailers, because I was always going to see Cloud Atlas, so I didn't have to worry. It's that I just can't deal with watching that terrible Lincoln trailer for a movie that's probably going to suck.
See, I know I'm going to see Lincoln, and yeah. I probably won't see Les Mis,
yeah.
But I just know I'm going to hate Lincoln.
Okay. Did anybody leave when you saw at any point during Cloud Atlas?
No, they didn't.
Okay.
And I was kind of prepared to see that.
One person left.
Okay, yeah.
But that person also might have been homeless. I'm no joke. Like, I honestly don't. I'm curious as to how they got in the theater, but she seemed homeless. She smelled very bad and was eating out of a giant tub of yogurt before she left.
Was it yogurt she was eating, though?
Judging by the smell of when she walked by me, I'm saying 60-40 maybe.
Yeah. I definitely heard someone on the way out. It sounded kind of like I saw them come into the theater and they seemed kind of apprehensive about each other. It was a kind of a male and female couple around our age, but I kind of got the vibe that it was maybe not a first date, but still pretty early on in their relationship.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they were both were trying to be friendly, but still not comfortable, it seemed.
Yeah.
You know that.
Yeah.
And then they kind of just sat there and the movie was over. So we had to walk over them to get out. And they're kind of just sitting there. And she went, "I don't know if I got it, but I liked it."
Okay. Well, this is something then, because I had a similar experience. I saw The Paperboy recently. I had to write a review about it for another website, songsandcigarettes.com. And I hated it. Like, just hated it. It was one of those movies. It was the follow-up from the director of Precious, based on the novel Push by Sapphire. And The Paperboy was just an awful, horrible movie that I hope nobody ever sees, and I hope every copy of it burns.
Based on the video game Paperboy by Sapphire?
No, it wasn't. but it was just one of those movies where it would just sort of, like, beat you over Pardon?
You usually don't say that about movies. That you just hated it and no one should see it.
Because it's the worst kind of movie, and this is exactly what I wrote about in my review. It's the type of movie that just it beats you into submission by showing you just things that are just so objectively horrible, like rapes and murders and just disgusting murders and just all these horrible things piling on scene after scene, that it just sort of covers up that the movie is horrible. There's no good writing, and it just shows you so many horrible things that smart people feel an obligation to say that they didn't get it. But they didn't always like it, but they got it or something like that. Because walking out of that movie, I expected everybody just like, that was a piece of shit because it was a piece of shit. But people were like, yeah, and like trying to justify to themselves why they liked it. And again, in that review, I sort of spelled out that I know that feeling because I used to, you know, I used to be able to be swayed by these movies. But now I just think it's sort of like, I don't know, it's so cheap to just beat you over the head with things until you agree with it, just by using things that are just objectively things that are horrible in society, like rape and disgusting murders and John Cusack's acting. But like, I don't feel that way about Cloud Atlas, because I feel like there was something beneath all of the, you know, the showy stuff that Cloud Atlas did. I feel like there was something beneath it that there wasn't in The Paperboy at all. So.
That's how you kind of summed up how I felt about my reaction versus a lot of people's reaction to Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Okay. Yep. That's fair. We won't rehash that argument that we've had many times. Okay.
Do you have anything else on Cloud Atlas?
I've got a...
Cloutless? Limitless?
Just stop it. So the thing about Bradley Cooper in this movie... the thing... We talked about this earlier. My favorite part of this movie and your favorite part of this movie was the scene about breaking barriers, where you sort of got, I think the person doing the voiceover in that scene is Hugo Weaving, when Jim Sturgess's character, who was on the ship, comes back after he's been saved by an escaped slave. And he's sort of you know, Jim Sturgess is going to leave Hugo Weaving or whatever. And again, I'm sorry that I'm butchering this, but this movie throws so much at you that I feel bad that we're doing a podcast after I've only seen it once. I feel like I'm totally letting everybody down. But no, he's just going to leave. And then Hugo Weaving is like, you can't just do that. Nobody will believe you. And of course, you know, Sturgess is going east to help the abolitionists. And the whole idea of this movie that I really like, and something that I think flows through the way it's been promoted, through interviews with the Wachowskis and Tickler to a lesser extent that I've been reading since seeing it. It's all about sort of just doing things unconventionally, and sort of every new idea is crazy until it works. Like, abolishing slavery probably seemed insane at one point. Like, it just seemed like something that would never happen. And even something as small as, I remember there was this podcast that Bill Simmons and Chuck Klosterman did together where Bill Simmons was like, you'll never win an NBA championship with more than like an 8-guy rotation in the playoffs. And Chuck Klosterman's like, yeah, that's only crazy until somebody pulls it off. And that sort of can be applied to everything from sports to slavery to whatever you want to apply it to. And the reason I like where they're breaking all the plates and stuff like that, coming underneath that voiceover, is that it's just sort of like you're smashing sort of these relics of an older time. Even if those relics are from a time that those people are currently living in, it's just sort of like, well, no, this is not how we're doing it. We're smashing it. And that's what Cloud Atlas is. It's sort of like, it's sort of accepting postmodernity as just modernity. And now it's just sort of like, now we're going even further with this. You know what I mean? And it's a very barrier-breaking movie, and it's all about original thought. And a quote I got from Lana Wachowski about selling this movie was that when they were trying to sell it, trying to get a budget for it, was that she said, the problem with market-driven art making is that movies are greenlit based on past movies. Warner rejected this movie initially because of how poorly The Fountain did. They compared it to The Fountain, and The Fountain didn't make money. So they're like, no, we have to pass on this. And then Lana continues with, so as nature abhors a vacuum, the system abhors originality. Originality cannot be economically modeled. And it's sort of, they had to go out of their way. And even, I think they estimated they put up about 10% of the budget themselves after somebody went bankrupt and couldn't afford to follow through on their part of the process. And it's just sort of all of these barriers you have to break through to do something original. And it's always, like I mentioned, I'm always just sort of happy when something new exists, because the things that I'm the most interested in are new things. And this movie feels new, and I like that it exists. And I want more movies like Cloud Atlas, even though I'll see it again and then may never watch it again. This will not be in my top 10 movies of the year. It will be
Paperboy 1 through 10.
Yeah, exactly. It's all taken up by Zac Efron. But no, this will not be one of my favorite 10 movies of the year. I don't think everybody should see it just because it's challenging and interesting. But I would love to live in a world where this movie is widely accepted as cool. If only because it's sort of just an idea based thing that doesn't always work, but is always interesting. So I don't know. I like good concepts, and this is definitely a good concept, and it works about as well as it can, I think.
Yeah, no, I find it very, and not just because it's doing something new, but I think in isolation, it is enjoyable to watch.
Yeah.
Like you can step back later, and there are definitely some cool things, as I said, about how these stories connect in ways that you might not just guess from the trailer. Mm-hmm. Be like, oh, that's Tom Hanks, and that's Tom Hanks, and you know, they do kind of the same thing and free somebody in a way. But I think it's watchable, like, which sounds like such a barely compliment.
It always sounds like an insult. Yeah.
Yeah. But while it's on screen, I think it's very watchable, and you can get more from it, you know, later if it's your kind of movie to look, you know, if that's your style to look back on something, and this does continue to give, I find.
Yeah.
You know, as I think about it and I talk about it and I read about it, I do find myself enjoying things I like more about it. Mm-hmm. And that's not just to say, you know, I'm reading people who want to seem smart. just even on my own, just thinking about it, you know, there are things I'm finding myself enjoying more. So, yeah, if it's doing something like that, again, to agree, it's not that it's the best movie made, but it's a positive experience, you know?
Yeah, and it always feels like a really personal movie as well. And again, I'm speaking for somebody I'll never meet, but and also I don't know as much about Andy Wachowski and Tom Tykwer as I do Lana Wachowski, just because she has been such a big part of the way this movie has sort of been not marketed, but sort of sold in the press from interviews I've seen.
And just the lens that a lot of these critics are looking at it through.
Yeah, exactly. It's very easy to see that sort of breaking barriers. Every idea seems crazy, or every new idea seems crazy until people actually follow through with it and it becomes accepted. You can easily add that to Lana's transition from Larry, you know, very easily.
Yeah.
And it's something that Lana said she struggled with a lot and was very depressed about before she became Lana and
contemplated suicide.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do feel like in more ways than one, this movie always comes across as feeling very personal. And I don't think that necessarily makes any movie better, like, by itself, but it makes the emotion behind it feel more real and more authentic. And even without knowing that, I feel like you can sort of get emotions out of this movie. I feel like there are parts of this movie that if I wasn't such a bastard sometimes would be much more emotionally affecting than they were to me. But I don't know. I feel like there's it really feels like there's real emotion in this movie and definitely real ideas as well. So I enjoy it. See it if you haven't. I don't know why you're listening to this if you haven't, or you haven't seen the movie, but do see it. It's worth it.
There you go. I thought you said you weren't going to do that. Tell people just to see it.
If they listen to people that listen to our podcast are the people I would recommend this movie to.
The best people in the world.
Yes, exactly. If I could rate them on iTunes, I would give them all 5 stars.
5 stars, you guys. Yeah. You keep it up.
Speaking about our own podcast, next week is our 100th episode, which seems crazy. But then I realized we've been doing this for almost 2 years. So I guess it makes sense, given that it's a weekly podcast.
At least 100 hours down the drain.
Oh, way more than that, man. anyway, next week we're going to do sort of like a clip show, I guess. We did it at episode 50. So we're just going to sort of go back through and find our favorite clips from the last 50 or so episodes. I think our David Fincher's episodes were like 53 and 54. So that's kind of where we're starting the clip show from. But we're going to give you some of our best stuff. And hopefully it'll be something that you can hand to people that have never listened to us before and be like, hey, this is a good representation of what these guys do. And you should listen to them.
Yeah. If there's anything that you particularly like that we've done over the past, I guess, 47, feel free to email us and let us know. And we'll make sure if a lot of people liked a certain thing, we'll include it.
Yeah, and I mean, we're not going to put in like 15-minute segments, but, you know, we tend to have these speeches throughout the podcast where we'll go for a few minutes on one topic, and if, you know, we like that idea, we'll throw it in the clip show. So, yeah, email us, themacguffinmen@gmail.com. Also send us a tweet, or send us a tweet, you know, if it's something that you can get across in 100 and however many characters you get in a tweet. We would appreciate your help, and it'll be up next week. And then we've got other podcasts coming up. We've got one on the new Bond movie. We've got one on The Wire that will be out eventually. I think we'll be doing a Quentin Tarantino podcast and some other cool ideas we've got coming.
QT!
So on that note, thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men, and be sure to check back next week.
I've been your hype man, James.
'Listening to the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.